Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
You can measure public opinion, and you can manipulate it. You can even create it, and politicians and corporations do all of those things. You can also think about it, the idea of public opinion and what role it plays in modern society. And that's the task Susan Herbst has set herself. She's a professor at the University of Connecticut, and she's just written A Troubled Birth, The 1930s and American Public Opinion. And the reason she highlights the 30s will become apparent as we talk. But first of all, just welcome, Professor.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
And let's just begin with the nature of public opinion. People started measuring it in the 30s. Did it exist before it was measured?
Yeah, it's a great question. Part of my argument has been through my entire career and all my work is that public opinion is a phantom. It's a reification, call it, it's social construction. And it only exists as we form it. That it depends on how you're measuring it, when you're measuring it, what you're going to do with it, and whether it's worth measuring. So there have been a variety of techniques over the years across nations to try to get at public opinion, depending on who you were. I mean, were you trying to sell the public something? Were you trying to rule the public? Were you trying to ready the public for war? Were you just trying to persuade the public in order to go along with a set of policies or get elected? So it's a very malleable concept. It's a very public opinion. Some people have argued in my field in the social sciences, maybe we should just stop using that phrase. So that's something I've thought a lot about too. It's elusive. There's too many ways to define it and think about it, but I think it's also very powerful.
Right. So you say that the way you measure it makes a difference to it, but presumably before you even measure it, you need to know there's a public, right? So that means that there's a community, I mean, a nation state maybe, or some other community, which can be measured.
Yeah, that you're thinking of the public as some bounded entity that you can query or question or watch their behavior, which, you know, there have always been behavioral measures of public opinion. In the United States, there was, you know, through the 19th century, debates about the public and how to think about public opinion, but, you know, not so much, in part because America was very, the population was so dispersed. You know, we were largely rural population. But in the 20th century, as there was urbanization, industrialization, people started moving to cities. There was more interest in some kind of a concrete populace instead of this diverse, you know, very dispersed public of the 19th century. There's this great, I think it's 1924, maybe 1927. It's an article in the American Political Science Review in the 20s, where the greatest minds in political science, some of the great white men of political science, are having a round table. And this article is a report on the round table where they're trying to come up with a shared definition of public opinion. So in the 1920s, in this you know, burgeoning field of social science, the great, you know, wise heads thought it would be good if we all had a common definition. And they go around and around and they can't agree. So weirdly, they decide at the end to just start measuring it. And the first time I read this, I read it a few times, is that since we can't agree on a definition of the term, let's just get out there and measure it. And for them, measurement meant the still new survey, you know, the sample survey.
Just to be clear about that, what did they actually disagree about in that conversation? What were the various ideas put forward?
One of the most important ones was whether the public needed to be informed or engaged to be worth measuring, to be worth paying attention to.
And it, in terms of global opinion, I mean, I remember at the BBC World Service where I used to work, that they were always coming up with, one of these companies did surveys of global opinion, but that hardly makes much sense, does it? Because it's too diffuse to mean much.
Yeah, and I'm always surprised when there's, you know, there are very serious people who work on polling in Russia, for example, or other authoritarian states. I mean, I don't know what you do with those data. I don't know what they could possibly mean. In democracies where they're polling, and you see these global polls, you know, which population is the happiest, for example, is a common poll you see. And the Scandinavians always do well on that for some reason. They're the happiest people. So in democracies, you know, the polling has the same struggles that we have here in the United States. But I'm always surprised to see people bothering to poll in authoritarian states. I can't imagine that a respondent would be open to a pollster.
Well, let's go back to the 30s, and you make the point in your book that polling started then, this whole idea of public opinion took off in the States at that time, and that it was an unusual time. There were lots of things, yeah, interesting things going on. There was broadcast media, there was the consumerism was coming in. You had a charismatic president, and it was the back end of a fierce recession, depression. So can you tell us a bit about why polling came in at that time and how those factors played in?
So many people in the 30s were worried about possible fascistic tendencies, authoritarianism rising in the United States. So watching what was going on in Europe, there was a lot of concern about that, especially among, you know, statesmen and journalists, intellectuals. So there was a fear in the air that, you know, populism, which, you know, in the late 19th century in the United States had been, the People's Party and kind of agriculturally based populism, that could turn very quickly into fascism. So in the 1930s, there was an obsession with populism, popularity, and which way that could go. So that's one of the things that drew me to the 30s, besides the fact that institutionally, public opinion measurement and expression gets formally started in the 30s, was this that we're walking on a knife's edge all the time between, you know, the popularity of an idea, of a leader, and authoritarianism. So the 30s, that just, it weighs very heavily on people. Conspiratorial thinking, you know, we've always had it. And there's the famous Richard Hofstadter article from the 1960s that I always assign to my students. That's about paranoia in American politics. We've always had conspiracies, but the 30s really, they did their work on conspiracies. There were a lot of concerns, of course, about FDR, and that all these New Deal programs that were being implemented were part of a takeover of the United States government by elites, you know, led by Roosevelt, call him left, call him right. Roosevelt himself was worried about a dangerous populist on his right, Father Coughlin, the quote-unquote radio priest, who is a extremely popular broadcaster, anti-Semite, had tried to cozy up to Roosevelt early in the 30s, and Roosevelt wasn't having it. So he was a danger on the right. And then Roosevelt, of course, had Huey Long, the famous governor turned senator from Louisiana, with his populism from the left. And Roosevelt worried about that, too. So it was a time when, you know, conspiracies, populism, fear of elites, anti-intellectualism, worries about radio. Radio was really diffusing in the 1930s. And there was a lot of worry about what it would be used for. I mean, we were watching Hitler make such effective use of radio in the 1930s, and we saw Father Coughlin doing it here. FDR certainly used it to his advantage. But these new media that had such a far reach and were so compelling, what were those going to do to us? And today we have social media and our concerns about that. So,
well, yes. So let me ask you directly then. I mean, do you think that radio in the 30s and social media platforms now, you know, are similar in that they are destabilizing in some way, and they are throwing confusion into the political system, both in the 30s and now?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And that's what the danger of somebody like Father Coughlin or Huey Long before he was assassinated in the early 30s, and which must have been some kind of relief to Roosevelt. Even Eleanor Roosevelt, who never said anything bad about anybody, said some things about Huey Long. So you had those people who were going to be very sophisticated users of media. I mean, the big difference, of course, is that radio is or at least it was in the 30s, a one-to-many medium. So there's a feedback loop in that broadcasters have market research, and they can, you know, they get feedback from the public about programming, but it's not very nuanced as compared to today, where you put out a tweet, you put out something in social media, and you are going to get direct feedback, you know, from people in their own words, in a way that you didn't have from the 30s.
Yeah, well, it's interesting to draw lessons, you know, from the way radio was handled for social media today. So I guess there was some regulation of radio through the FCC, although not much compared to Europe. And then you also have to wonder about whether radio remained a destabilizing force. I mean, we've got the right-wing shock jocks in the US who've had quite a big impact. And, you know, looking further afield, places like Rwanda recently, they were, you know, radio was thought to have inspired the genocide there. So radio has remained powerful. And I guess, you know, the lesson may be that social media will need regulation, but it too will still leave a big mark, you know, 50, 60, 70 years from now.
And let me say too about radio, it's, boy, radio is still, and now, I mean, there's a kind of a, it's hard to draw the line between radio and podcasts, because so many podcasters who have very big audiences, you know, it is the same general, you know, it's the same functionality as radio, even though you get on it differently. And look at Rush Limbaugh's impact on American politics. I mean, it is profound. You know, it's absolutely profound. And we've got similar broadcasters today. There's as you know, having worked for the BBC and given what you do now, the voice, radio podcasting is so incredibly intimate. And we still have no medium quite like it. You know, when you can't see the person and you can hear them, there's this kind of intimacy that, you know, early researchers of the radio were just absolutely amazed by. That kind of intimacy is I don't think it'll ever be replaced, hence the popularity of the podcast.
Yeah, it is a defining characteristic of radio. I mean, it was slightly off topic, but it always struck me, having done, you know, 30 years of it with the BBC, that people would write to me and I was astonished because they really knew me. And it was just really shocking to me that radio was that, just as you say, intimate, that people could work things out just from your voice and hesitations and pauses and so on. So it does remain powerful. But getting back to our, you know, subject, the 30s were striking as well in that there was a question about what it meant to be American, which you again have today, right? Maybe caused again by this new media that's come on the scene. It's encouraged a debate, which again is a parallel.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. And so it was something journalists, intellectuals, college professors, newspaper editors, they were concerned about. So we have all these tools now. We have the public opinion polls we're starting up, and there's immigration. I mean, after the 1920s, when immigration was really slowed by the federal government, the number of immigrants decreased, you know, pretty dramatically in the United States. But there were many, many immigrants and ethnic minorities here already that had come in the late 19th century and the early 20th century. So the population was changing between the advent of technology, how to measure public opinion, the advent of radio, a new compelling communication technology, urbanization, and immigrants, either recent or second generation, trying to integrate into this, you know, our alleged melting pot. There was a lot of anxiety about who was really American and who wasn't. And the magazine Harper's ran a contest in the early 1930s where they asked readers to write essays, and you can win $1,000 or some very big prize for back then, the winner. And they couldn't, you know, they were just bombarded with so many entries, and the thing was such a mess that they had to, you know, write about that. That we, here we are, an American public that the president, you know, FDR says we're a public. Manufacturers say we're a public. They say we're a public of consumers. Radio acts like we're a public, but we don't really know what it is to be an American public. So we're being told we're an American public, but we don't know what it means to be American. So hence a lot of tension and fighting about that. So do you want me to talk about the that broadcast, Americans All, Immigrants All?
Okay, let's hear about that.
I think probably, you know, the first really progressive attempt at coming to grips with our immigration, our diversity as a nation, started in the late 1930s by FDR's Department of Education. It was called something else, along with CBS, decided to air a program for months on end. It came on every Sunday called Americans All, Immigrants All. And each time, each broadcast took on a different ethnic population, including Jews and African Americans, although they were hardly, you know, immigrants in the sense that some of the others were. So that was an early progressive attempt by a broadcaster in the federal government to try to get at this question, what is an American? And the answer for them was an American is somebody who wants to be here, you know, somebody who strive to get here or found themselves here and wants to contribute their, this is very common language in the 1930s, their gifts, whether that's the talents with their hands or their minds, scientists, artists, whatever. So people were worried about this question, who was American, and there were progressives trying to answer the question too.
Now then, you have in your book tried to expand the idea of measuring public opinion from surveys and polls to a broader description, well, study and description of cultural themes. So we've talked a bit about radio, but you also look at world fairs, for example, as an expression of public opinion. Can you just talk us through that?
Well, in the 1920s and 1930s, those men who were interested in public opinion, they were sociologists and they were historians, and they had a kind of a broader perspective on the world. But as the social sciences became more quantitative, social scientists of the last many decades have been less historically oriented, have really failed to look at cultural indicators of public opinion. Most important, I think, is what entertains people, what people are drawn to, what excites them, what moves them. Call it infotainment, call it entertainment, call it whatever. But the world's fairs, which in the U.S. had two just spectacular world's fairs in the 1930s, one in Chicago, one in New York. Those were places where tens of millions of people, you know, passed through the gates in the summertime over two summers. And you can take the world's fairs exhibits, the forms of entertainment, people's reactions to the fairs, their incredible popularity. And you can look at the World's Fairs as a text about public opinion in the 1930s. You know, what exhibits were put out there by industries, by manufacturers. Of course, the great American industrial giants had, you know, spectacular exhibits, as did state governments. And many nations, of course, exhibited their foods and their dance and their culture. And you know, Americans came from all over the country to the fair and found it incredibly engaging. But the fairs are a text about public opinion. What excited us? What moved us? And also, the fairs were a kind of a way to measure public opinion. So you know, whenever you have a technology of public opinion, it has two sides. It's a measurement technique, but it's an expression technique. So the World's Fair, the same way, it was a way that people through their attendance were and their enjoyment were expressing public opinion. It was a way for manufacturers like GM, for example, or GE, these big firms, to also measure public opinion. You know, what do people like about our exhibits? What are they interested in? And so it had that function as well.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
But it seems to me, I mean, if you look at, let's say, those world fairs, and they might send you in the right direction, presumably, about what Americans are thinking and what American public opinion is. But isn't the unique thing about this whole area that you can measure it with these polls quite accurately? And so, you know, the World Fair may prompt you to ask the right questions in a survey, but still the survey's the thing.
Yeah, I mean, so now we're getting into just the problem, the fundamental problems of surveying. There's the one of the toughest problems. People get distracted about what are the problems, what aren't. Sampling the public is the least of our problems. I mean, there are ways to do sampling scientifically. That's not an issue. Interviewer effects, people used to get hung up on that. Like, could the interviewer in a scientific survey somehow sway the respondent? That's really, you know, most, you know, good firms and academics know how to keep the interviewers' opinions and persuasions out of it. The problems of survey research have been there from the very beginning, and they're profound. There's the question of, you know, how often. So people change their minds. And sometimes, especially if the issue is not one that they're well informed about, they can change their minds often. They can change their minds in response to watching Tucker Carlson. And as he changes his minds, they may change their minds. So there's always the question of, you know, when you're polling. There's the question of whether the audience understands the issue or not, the framing of the question. You know, none of those problems have gone away, no matter how sophisticated we get about sampling. Now, in terms of pre-election polling, that is very accurate. And people shouldn't be distracted by the fact that we thought Hillary Clinton would win over Donald Trump. I mean, that was a very clear failure of state polling organizations and, you know, newspapers that have very little money to do this, in particular states, not polling often enough, close enough to the election. I mean, that was a very particular problem with the quality of state polls. The national polls usually hit it on the head. So pre-election polling it's fine. You know, and you can argue that it ruins the campaign and all that kind of thing. But I guess I've always been more interested in attitude polling and issue polling more than just the vote choice.
Well, wasn't there a bigger problem there? If you take that, I was going to ask you about this, the Clinton-Trump race. I think it's fair to say that the political commentariat in the US, vast bulk of it, failed to see Trump coming. And yet, you know, a few insightful commentators, and indeed activists like Bannon, did see it coming. And they were onto something that the polls didn't seem to reflect. Is that right? So that, I mean, that's surprising, right? You would think that opinion polls would have been able to see what people's concerns were that might lead them to support Trump over Clinton.
It's one of the points in my book, and Trump is just, he's absolutely perfect for this thesis, is Trump has a incredibly keen sense of American public opinion. And it's, and he's had his setbacks. You know, The Apprentice was wildly popular until it wasn't, but shifted gears, made up, you know, got onto the birtherism bandwagon. He has this, just this incredible sense of figuring out, you know, how cruelty can work as a persuasive mechanism, what Americans are anxious about. He's, you know, he's, you got to argue that he's a kind of a brilliant theorist of American public opinion. And he was not, as he rose in his success and as he eventually won the election. I mean, that was a campaign that was slapped together for a long time. You know, he wasn't a person who was always looking at opinion polls. I mean, he looked at ratings for The Apprentice. He was very interested in ratings because he knew and knows that what people do with entertainment, what people are interested in entertainment, whether they're interested in contests or cruelty or competition, what people like, celebrities, so forth, that's who they are. I mean, that's a kind of a public opinion measurement, that kind of what people watch, listen to, like to do for fun, that's incredibly valuable, much more valuable than anything you could count in a nice, you know, kind of quote-unquote scientific poll.
Well, that's so interesting, because I mean, that really does suggest that polls have very limited utility, because you've got someone here who, you know, somehow has insights into the American psyche, who is outperforming in terms of his understanding of how to sway public opinion and get votes. All the well-paid analysts in the Democratic Party, in the Republican Party, in the newspapers and universities, all the rest of it, who failed to see it as clearly as he did.
I showed my students some clips of Sarah Palin, when she was running for vice president with John McCain in 2008. And they were really taken with her. And I said, you're not the only ones with her. She was such great foreshadowing for Trump. And I'm sure he was watching that. But he was good at it, too, even better than her, that the way to talk to people, to entice them, to worry them, to play on their anxieties. I am very worried about the meanness and the cruelty, which Sarah Palin, you know, you see a bit of that. Because she's a woman, it kind of came off a little bit softer, but Trump was watching that compelling way that she had, and okay, it turned out poorly for her and John McCain, but she was onto something, and her style and her engaging way were really something, you know, very, very intriguing.
One of the issues that always comes up with polling for an election is, you know, does it have predictive power? And the pollsters will keep saying, no, we're not predicting anything. We're just measuring what opinion is today. But obviously, people read polls with a view to predictive power. And you're saying that Trump's cultural understanding gave him predictive power. So when you look ahead at the future of public opinion and trying to work out which way it's going, would you rely more on polls or on a study of culture and maybe particularly the media to give you insight into where things are going?
You know, I think both. I mean, I had some training in survey research. I think it has value. I mean, something I get accused of a lot is that I want to destroy polling or survey research. And that's not the case. I just think that it needs to be put in its place along with other kinds of measures, other kind of indicators. You know, public opinion, the public sentiment is so complex that it's going to need multiple measures. That said, political scientists in particular, I mean, sociologists and anthropologists they're broader than we are in so many ways, and historians certainly are. We need to listen to popular music. We need to watch Dancing with the Stars. You know, like we really need to take popular culture seriously and not just hold it in disdain. Most of my students, you know, they watch YouTube all day. You know, they're not watching necessarily the highest rated show on ABC television, you know, so we're going to have to pay more attention to what looks like it's what looks like is trivial. So we missed the boat on Trump. You know, he, because of The Apprentice, because of his celebrity, he had a massive audience that found him incredibly attractive. And we missed that whole thing. And there's, you know, I mean, I don't have any colleagues who say that, oh, back when Trump was incredibly popular with The Apprentice, I could see that he would be a political leader that could possibly win the presidency. Nobody's saying that.
Well, I think Steve Bannon is, actually. And when you look at the various people trying to understand modern society, you know, you've got the pollsters, you've got political scientists, as you say, you've got historians and anthropologists, but you've also got artists, you've got people in advertising who, mm-hmm. you know, so in a whole series of Mad Men was sort of built on the idea that, you know, a brilliant ad executive could have some sort of insight into social trends that others weren't quite seeing as quickly as he did. So when you look at all those different groups, which do you think has the best tools to predict where and understand where things are going?
You know, we have some sociologists and some political scientists now who are doing the really labor-intensive work of talking to people. And it means going to people. And one of the problems with survey research is that you call people or contact them by the internet anonymously. You tell you don't know who they are. They don't know who you are. Nobody reading the poll will see their opinion. You know, there's all that anonymity is critical for survey research. We as social scientists, and I think some of the best people studying public opinion now, are trying to talk to people in their natural communities. So one of my favorite colleagues is a professor at the University of Wisconsin, Kathy Kramer, who started out doing this work in a kind of a lonely way, but has really spent 20, 30 years now talking to many of the same people in the same communities throughout the state of Wisconsin, especially in the rural areas. She could see in her work some of what we're seeing with Trump and the kind of anxieties that people felt in the Midwest, what they were worried about, tensions over things like race and entitlements, the notion of being left behind by an American elite. You know, she was seeing, because she had such, you know, so many depth conversations for so many years with people ensconced in their natural communities. There's nothing wrong with, as sociologists know well, and Arlie Hochschild is also a great person who studies kind of red America these days, that it's okay to study people in groups in their natural environments where they tend to be more forthright. And that's not to be confused with focus groups, which, you know, you see oftentimes on television, they've picked, you know, journalists and network have picked a focus group of people who don't know each other. And they're an artificial community that are kind of ridiculous. You need to go to people in their real communities where they're going to feel very comfortable talking about the texture of their lives, what they hope for, what they're concerned about. So I think some of the best public opinion research will be about doing this. It's, people don't like to do it because it means, you know, going on the road and, you know, spending a lot of time with people and hearing them out at length. So there's some, you know, excellent journalists who do this sort of work, but it's expensive, it's time consuming, but I don't think there's any way around it.
Professor, thanks so much for giving us your analysis of what's going on in the field of public opinion. Very interesting.
Yeah, it's my pleasure.